Good morning and welcome to the Weekly Reader. I'm Kara Garby-Balserzak, and today my guest is the poet Catherine Kaiser. Catherine's latest collection of poetry, Pretend the World, was just published by the Duluth-based publisher Holy Cow Press. She joins us today by phone from her home in St. Paul. Catherine, welcome to the Weekly Reader.
Thank you.
Could you start by reading us one of the poems from the collection?
Yes, I can. And you had asked if I could read a poem called The Fruit.
Yes.
And the beginning of this poem, I was doing a residency down at the Anderson Center in Red Wing, and I walked downstairs to breakfast one morning, and there was a newspaper article in the Star and Tribune that Planned Parenthood was working not only with young Hispanic women, but also with their mothers to talk about family planning, because many of the mothers really didn't understand necessarily where babies came from and what the process of impregnation and birth was. And I thought, wow, that would be so bizarre to not know. And so I took that question into this poem. It's called The Fruit. Quote, Guardo said she remembers growing up believing that women got pregnant simply by sitting next to a man. And that's Minneapolis Star and Tribune, 2005. Unlike the virgin, there was no annunciation. No angel came unto me with a halo of light and a thin, graceful finger pointing at my flat belly. I thought a woman could get pregnant just by sitting next to a man. I avoided my uncle's teasing lap, stayed safe in my circle of girls on the dusty barrio playground. How did it get inside me? A message from the desert hare, the whisper of the aloes, the scratch of the cactus in the wind, the trail of the turtle through the sand, the grunt of the desert peccary? Did God whisper his will inside me? Was it the pit of a peach I accidentally swallowed, the apple seed that innocently slid down my throat, un huevo fertilized by some cock, the bull's testicles served at my cousin's wedding? El beso bestowed upon me by the priest, a cockroach crawled inside me. I whisper with my friend Maria, we cannot ask the sisters at the convent, and our mothers turn their heads in silence, arms grinding corn, kneading dough for tortillas, rubbing twisted cloths up and down corrugated washboards. Was it a bird bringing my wish for a child, or is this the fate of Eve like the monthly visitation? I am alone. My stomach grows round, hard, not like a rock, but a ball, a piñata, a soft paper skin filled with small gifts.
Thank you so much, Catherine. That's such a beautiful poem. One of the reasons I asked you to read it is because, I loved it when it moved me when I read it, but also it's such a good example of a persona poem, and you have a number of persona poems in the collection, poems where you speak in another person's voice, and some of those, you know, there's one that seems to be the perspective of, you know, a child. There are others that take place even, you know, more than 100 years ago. There's one from the perspective of a Chinese garment worker. There's such a diverse array of voices you use, and I'm just wondering what inspires you to write in those other voices?
Well, I think when I first started writing poetry, I was very concerned about myself and expressing my emotions and my angst, and as I've gotten older, I feel less angst-ridden. I don't quite know why I was so upset when I was 20. Why was I so riled up back then? But I think my horizon has expanded. I'm also influenced by fiction. I read a lot of fiction, and so the persona poem is oftentimes a monologue, a character speaking about his or her life for a short piece, so it's sometimes a dramatic monologue. So you can see the similarity then with fiction and also with drama when you look at the persona poem. I write because I puzzle about things. I want to understand things. So with this particular poem, I wanted to understand, wow, what would that be like to not know how you got pregnant and where a baby came from? The Chinese garment worker poem that you talked about came from several triggers, from watching a documentary film, from my experiences teaching in Guangzhou in southern China. But the trigger for that was my daughter got some stuff from Land's End, and it said inspected by number 5 on this little slip of paper in her underwear. And I thought, oh, my gosh, who is number 5? Who is this woman inspecting my daughter's clothing, and what is her life like? So I write sometimes to puzzle these things out and to try to answer this question for myself.
It's interesting that you reference the dramatic monologue and sort of the theater connection, because I noticed that the book is divided into three sections, but instead of calling them maybe part one or part two, which I'm used to seeing, you call them act one, act two, and act three, like a play. So is that related to this idea of the dramatic monologue?
To a certain extent, yes. And the book is shaped, I think, like a play, in the three acts. And I worked with Jim Selar, who's an independent publisher and editor, with the book, and he kind of helped me shape it, so it was in part his idea. Some of that came from the poem Frankie in the Attic, which I wrote after I saw Tony Kushner's Carolina or Change at the Guthrie, and I just kind of had this idea of acts and how you organize theater in my mind as I worked on that poem, and then took that idea and sort of helped shape the whole book with that. The three acts are very distinct. The first act is about children, and starts with children in a childlike voice, both my own and my children's, and then kind of goes as the kids get older and then kind of moves towards the outside world. The second act then is most of the persona poems and the historical poems. And then the third act is the author kind of as an adult, the speaker of the poems as an adult, and kind of adult sensibilities, the love poems and other issues are in that section.
I know it had been, 9 years since you published your earlier collection of poems, Dark Lake. Did you end up with, you know, a lot more poems than you could put into this book? And was that organization part of how you sort of whittled down what would go in the book? Or did it seem very obvious to you what should go in?
No, it didn't at all, which was one of the reasons I had both Jim Perlman at Holy Cow Press and Jim Selar helping me edit it. It was kind of a big mess about a year and a half ago, and I really didn't know how to organize it. It was so, I so wanted to organize it in a chronological order. This is the order that the poems were written in, but that was not the best dramatic organization. Mm-hmm. So it really took the outside eye of not one but two editors to help me figure that out, and I'm so grateful. And that's a lesson for all of your listeners who are writers, that we still need, no matter what stage of our careers we're at, we still need those other eyes. We still need some other people to help us figure things out. But yes, there's a lot of poems that aren't in this book as well.
Can you talk a little bit about the title, Pretend the World, and where it came from?
Well, I had to choose the title when it was a big mess a year and a half ago. So I thought, well, what encompasses this large, large manuscript where we were going from Guangzhou to historic Mackinac Island in 1830 to, the neighborhood in the Midway in the St. Paul that I grew up in. So there's a lot of pretending, both children pretending, but also adults pretending. And a lot of the first poems were born after 9/11, and I had to pretend to my children, who were very small at that time, that didn't happen. And I couldn't turn on the TV. So the pretending is the children pretending, it's the adults pretending. There's a lot of issues about safety and not being safe and pretending to be safe when you're not safe. So those are all threads through the book. But also it's my world. And your listeners can't see the cover, but it's a beautiful painting by Julie Buffalohead, who's a local Ojibwe artist. And it's a pregnant woman laying down with a mask on her face, and the mask refers to the persona poems. But she's also dreaming. She's pretending her own world. And so that's where the title comes from as well.
It seems like such a perfect cover for the themes in the book. Did she paint it just for you, or did you happen to serendipitously stumble across it?
I was led to her work by my friend Hyde Erdrich, who curates All My Relations Gallery, and that painting really jumped out at me. There was a couple of other ones. I was also interested in some paintings by Carolyn Lee Anderson, and I'm actually going to be doing an art show with several artists that's going to be up at Banfield Lock Center for the Arts in August and September, which will be called Pretend the World, and it will be the artists responding to the poems in the book, and then I'm going to then respond to their artwork this summer, and so Carolyn and Julie are two of the artists that will be in there.
You're listening to The Weekly Reader on KMSU. If you're on Facebook, you can become a fan of The Weekly Reader to get notice about our guests each week, and you can also subscribe to our free podcast in the iTunes store. Today, my guest is Catherine Kaiser, author of the poetry collection Pretend the World. So, Catherine, I had requested another poem, The Hideaway. Would you be willing to read that now?
Absolutely. And this takes place in St. Paul in 1972. The Hideaway. The purple tree was the color of dust in moonlight, the bark brown in its slow death, the split in the branches low enough to reach by standing on a bike seat. Nestled in the hollows, we'd lean back, ponder the shimmering stars in the darkening late summer sky, the leaves painted orange by sunset. It was imminent, the start of school, the change of season, our feet outgrowing our beat-up summer shoes, the bombs falling on TV. The news was bad, the body count climbing, my mother distraught, my father taking his students to peace marches, the men in black cars parked outside on our silent street waiting. That girl running on a flat dirt road, her naked body slick, smooth, and strong. How could I share my favorite bell bottoms and purple shirt, ride her on my banana bike, lean her into the arms of the tree, the only flames, the sunset in the distance?
Thanks for reading that. That's one of the poems that has a, you know, reference to a war going on. You refer to a number of wars in the book, Iraq, Kosovo, Vietnam, World War II. Those were at least the ones I counted. Do you consider yourself to be a political writer?
That's a very good question, and you know, I kind of go back to the 1960s saying the personal is political. A lot of the poems are from viewing the war from the point of view of the domestic. So I've got a poem about making sandwiches while listening to the news in Iraq from the kitchen. And the Iraq war started when my children were small. There's poems about 9/11. And this is a poem, of course, about the strange time when I was growing up, when my special time with my dad was sitting on his lap watching Walter Cronkite on the CBS News, watching the body count. And it was that strange, oh, I'm spending time with my dad, how special, while we were watching the count.
Wow.
So I think there's this idea of personal closeness and personal safety, you know, as I was snuggled up on my dad's lap, and yet we're not safe. In the larger world, there are all these horrible things taking place, and so I think part of one of the things the book tries to do is make sense of all of that, and how do we explain that to ourselves and to our children?
I want to go back to something you were saying a little bit earlier about collaboration with visual artists, and I saw you read a few weeks ago alongside a musician, which was a really great experience, and it doesn't seem like that collaboration happens as much in the art world as maybe it could or it should. And I'm curious just about how you got involved in so much collaboration and what you feel the value of that is to your process as a writer or to the arts community in general.
Well, honestly, I think it's kind of boring when a writer just stands up in front of a group of people and reads in a monotone voice from a book. I don't think it's a very exciting performance situation. So I'm trying to, as I'm going around and doing readings, to collaborate with artists and musicians, work with other writers. I'm going to be reading at Birchbark Books on Thursday this week, and Hyde Erdrich will be one of my guests, and I'm going to have Beth Mayer, another writer, who's actually a fiction writer, who's going to read a poem with me. And so I think part of it just enlivens the performance, it adds depth to the poems, and it's exciting for me to be working with other artists. Writing is a very isolated kind of task, and I've been writing these poems by myself since 2002, so it's so nice to be sharing them with other people and sharing the experience with other people, and I think it makes it a more thrilling experience for the audience.
Now, when you had your book launch event, which is at the Loft Literary Center in Minneapolis last month, you had a number of other Minnesota poets, sort of a star lineup of a lot of really great local poets reading with you, and also two people who were called poetry singers, and I wasn't able to attend the reading, and I'm just dying of curiosity, what exactly is a poetry singer?
Well, Anna George Meek, who's a fantastic poet, is also a very accomplished singer, and so she sang one of my poems last October, which is the first poem in the book, and put it to a classic aria. And it's beautiful, and you can find it on YouTube if you Google Anna Meek or my name. And we're going to be posting all of those readings from that Loft Literary Center on my website, which is katherinekaiser.com. And you can find videos of some other videos that we showed also at the Loft. I'm collaborating with an old student of mine who is a videographer and a photographer, and she's made two videos with some of my poems. So she's added the visuals as I did the voiceover to the poem. So we showed those as well. So we had music, we had film that night, but I hate being the center of attention for a big event like that. So it was wonderful. I got to sit and listen to other people read my work, and it was so phenomenal to hear Ed Bach Lee read my Red Lake poem. The poems gained depth and meaning by the other people reading them. So it was a very exciting event for me, too, and I enjoyed it greatly.
Did you sort of learn new things about your own work when you heard other people read them or sing them?
I did. I think one of the most powerful readings for me was David Lee Grant, an African-American playwright, read a poem about my grandfather being discriminated against because he was German. And before he read it, David did some research about how the Germans were hung and driven out of town and their houses burned down in Minnesota during World War I and World War II. And so it was so very interesting for him to bring that historical information and perspective that I didn't know about to the poem. So it did add a tremendous amount of depth.
Now, a few years ago, you edited an anthology called Writing Shotgun. And in an interview you gave at that time, you said that you still considered yourself to be an emerging writer. And I'm just curious now that you're quite accomplished as a writer. You've published now your second poetry collection. You edited that anthology. You've had other, numerous publications and awards. I'm curious, do you feel now that you're an established writer? And, what do you think is the value of these kinds of labels, maybe outside of the world of, applying for grants and having to label yourself?
Well, it really is grant information, and I think it's how granters kind of decide if we're at the beginning or in the middle of our career. That's a hard question. I think, to a certain extent, poets are always emerging because poets just are not widely read in many ways. So you can have two books of fiction out, and everybody can know you, and you can have two books of poetry out, and people don't really know who you are. Mm-hmm. So part of it, I think, is based on genre, and I don't know. I'm somewhere in between emerging and... and established. I'm not quite sure. What do you think?
Well, I think that's the humble answer, but I think there are a lot of people in the community would consider you established now. You might have to put yourself out of the running for some of those emerging writers. Although, I guess actually I see two books as sort of being a marker in the industry sometimes. I don't know mm-hmm. if that's arbitrary. It's an interesting label, though. You did mention how difficult what a difficult time poets can have finding readers. And I was curious, especially right now, the publishing industry is in such a state of change with the move to e-readers and things going online and the economy and people are reading less. And, we keep hearing all of these dire predictions. And have you seen that affecting the poetry world as well? I feel like I hear about that often in relation to prose, and maybe in a sense because poetry has always kind of struggled to find a readership more so than prose. But do you see that mm-hmm. impacting the poetry world as well?
Well, that's one of the reasons that I'm really excited to be making some videos and getting those online and making podcasts so that people can listen to poems on MP3s, they can go to YouTube and watch myself or watch some other people read my poems. And they're just short, 2 or 3 minute videos. I really think we've got to change how we disseminate poetry and how we share poetry. And I'm very excited to kind of explore some of this on the internet. My publisher is very willing to put my book up as an e-reader, but the problem right now is the lineation changes. So a prose piece, as you enlarge it on, say, a Nook or something, it affects the pagination, but it doesn't affect how the work is presented on the page. With a book like mine, where I've got, the poems shaped in very specific, particular ways that are important to the aesthetic integrity of the poem, if you enlarge it on the e-reader, you're not going to see the poem in the same way. So we're not going to be putting my book up as an e-book until they figure that out.
Now, before we wrap up, I know you have some upcoming readings that maybe you could mention for our listeners, and just you mentioned also a new publication you have coming out, so maybe do you want to just talk about that a little bit before we wrap up?
Yeah, I'll be reading Thursday night at Birch Bark Books with Hyde Erdrich and Beth Mayer. And I do have a new poem that just came out in Garrison Keillor's Good Poems, American Places. It's a very old poem of mine called Escape from Paradise, Iowa. about being young. It's my Bruce Springsteen poem. So that's in that book. And I've got lots of readings coming up in May and June. Stillwater, I will be at Valley Books, and I'm also going to be at the Bookcase in Wayzata. And both of those I'm reading with novelist and memoir writer Sarah Stonich, who's going to be reading from her new book, Shelter.
And she was just on the program 2 weeks ago.
Wow. Yeah, we're having fun, and it's kind of an unexpected pairing, her memoir and my poetry book, but they both have to do with motherhood, and they both have to do with identity, and they both have to do with being up north. So there's some interesting connections and dialogues between our two books.
You've been hearing from the poet Catherine Kaiser. Her book, Pretend the World, is available now from Holy Cow Press. To learn more about Catherine, you can visit her website, katherinekaiser.com, and her name is spelled KatherineKysar. Catherine, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thanks so much for having me.